and FM. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from the Portland State University Hatfield School of Government, offering a new master's degree in nonprofit leadership for those who believe in the power of collective action for social change. More information online at pdx.edu/Hatfield School.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society 2018-19 concert season. The season finale features singer-songwriter Dave Stamey performing songs of the American West.
That's Dave Stamey on Friday, May 17th at the Reedwood Friends Church at 2901 Southeast Steele Street in Portland. Doors at 7, concert 7:30 p.m.
Cowboy poet Tom Swearingen will open, and the Portland Folk Music Society Concert Committee will announce the 2019-20 season.
For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Sweetgrass County line, down where the Everstone flows.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bridging Cities Building Collaboration, a trauma-informed care training conference from Tuesday, May 14th through Thursday, May 16th at PDX First in Portland. The Trauma-Informed Care Training Conference will connect community partners, churches, and law enforcement on the West Coast to give them the knowledge, tools, and resources to engage, further develop, or improve collaboration on behalf of sex trafficked victims and complex trauma survivors in our communities. Again, that's Bridging Cities Building Collaboration, a Trauma-Informed Care Training Conference, Tuesday, May 14th through Thursday, May 16th at PDX First, 6100 Southeast Rab Road in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome, dear listeners. Thanks for tuning in. That was Spacer, and if it's Spacer, it's Preference. We're here bringing you queer and trans news, cultural events, and all the good stuff here every Tuesday on the second and fourth weeks of the month. We're so glad to be here. I'm Hattie, your host. We have Aria Saeed on the telephone with us today. Aria, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I have been very excited, very honored to to be reading these past couple of weeks about the work that you're doing. But before we dig into that, do you want to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, it is, the honor is also mine as well. So my name is Aria Saeed, and I'm 29 years old, and I am a co-founder and the executive director of the world's first transgender district, and its name is the Compton Transgender Cultural District in San Francisco's famed Tenderloin neighborhood, where it is the site of the United States' first documented uprising of queer and transgender people in August of 1966. I have been an advocate for transgender people for over a decade. And I am actually from Portland, Oregon. I'm born and raised in Portland, in Northeast Portland in particular. So it is an honor to come full circle back to my roots.
Wonderful. What neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up in Northeast Portland around Skidmore and Haight, Mississippi Ave, New area, and then like 16th and Killingsworth. But I also, I went to Benson High School. Let's see, what else? Jesuit, other schools in the neighborhood, in Beaverton for a little bit. So I've been all over Portland.
Did you say, you said Skidmore and 8th?
And Haight.
Oh, gotcha.
H-A-I-G-H-T.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
Yeah.
All right.
So when I learned about this opportunity, I was so excited because I haven't been back home in years, so thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Let's clarify one thing. It's the Compton's possessive transgender cultural district. Is that right?
Yes.
So let us begin right there. What does that mean to say that it's Compton's possessive? I wish there was another way to say that.
So Compton's was actually a restaurant chain in San Francisco. And I don't know when they started, but they were pretty prominent in the 1960s. And there were multiple sort of, I don't want to say a franchise, but there were there was a Compton's Cafeteria, which was the name of the restaurant on Turk and Taylor in San Francisco. And I believe there were two more locations, if I'm not mistaken. And so Gene Compton was actually the owner of this restaurant. He himself was a white cisgender man. And he didn't really have anything to do with the history in terms of the riot or anything like that. But what was significant was that Compton's Cafeteria was much like Stonewall, and people are very familiar with sort of, you know, the story of the Stonewall riots, and this year being the 50th anniversary of that riot. Mm-hmm. So Compton's Cafeteria just happened to sort of be the place, and culturally at that time, transgender people, drag queens, queer people would frequent the restaurant late at night and in the after hours. And of course, San Francisco, like many other cities, had very strict cross-dressing laws. So you were not legally allowed to wear more than 3 articles of clothing that belonged to the quote-unquote opposite sex. Otherwise, you'd be subject to arrest and you'd be put in jail. And it was licensed for police to arrest queer people, trans people specifically, and drag queens during that time. However, of course, as we know how laws are enforced, the Tenderloin was that gray space where there was so much activity that the law wasn't necessarily always enforced. However, the police would do regular raids and arrest trans people and drag queens at places like the Compton's Cafeteria. And of course, as we know of you know, the LGBT or the gay liberation movement and where it is now. Well, back then, you know, a series of events led to the frustration of trans and queer people to then start a riot. And so after ongoing harassment and frustration with police is what led to that night being a riot in particular.
And we're talking about August 1966, I believe.
Yes.
And so we're several years before Stonewall. And Christina Hanhart, in doing her research, notes when she was looking at queer activism in San Francisco in the late 60s that Stonewall actually didn't register in San Francisco as far as she could tell. Just, you know, it's hard to remember, but there was a time when, you know, there were just a few news outlets, and if you didn't hear about anything else, word of mouth,
exactly.
It just didn't exist for you. So there weren't national movements in the way that there are now. There were regional, there were local, and you know, I think folks probably did their best to bring news back and forth. So I think that's one of the reasons it's so fascinating to me that there's this what do you refer to as placemaking happening in creating this cultural district.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that last part.
What I said was that's why it's so fascinating to me that there is what you call placemaking, that's inherent in creating this cultural district, actually putting roots down and saying, this isn't just some idea that a lot of people were passionate about. It's a thing that people did in a time and in a place.
Yeah. It's very important to us. You know, for me as a trans woman in particular, to be able to actually see the legacy that we have inherited as trans people in particular is just absolutely important. And I think with queer and transgender history, it's very muddy. There's a lot of oral history, right? And there's a lot of learning about the legacy and the work of people before us in one way. But when we're thinking about queer spaces as historic assets to living and breathing communities that live in these neighborhoods now, very rarely do you find significant paper trail. And that was just because once upon a time, not too long ago, it was sort of illegal, for lack of a better word, to be transgender in the United States. And it was illegal to be gay or lesbian or non-binary or, you know what I mean? And so we do have some placemaking efforts. There is a plaque that commemorates the history of the riot in itself and an acknowledgement from the city of San Francisco that this event did contribute to the broader gay liberation movement in the United States and perhaps the world. But I think what is intentional for us in terms of the transgender district is promoting and celebrating the resilience and resistance of transgender people, as well as the culture of trans people, and all that variance, and literally have it translated tangibly in the neighborhood. Because trans people have quietly sort of resided in this neighborhood as early documented as the 1920s, and perhaps before then, we'll never know. And I think we deserve to be able to see a tangible representation of our lives and journeys in the neighborhood that we live in.
Yeah, wonderful. This is Preference. I'm chatting with Aria Saeed, co-founder and executive director of the Compton's Transgender Cultural District in San Francisco. From what I was reading, housing for transgender folks is part of how you plan to live out this cultural district. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, so I think we are in an interesting space in our society. I think there is sort of a subconscious belief that transgender people fell out of the sky in 2007, and now we're asking folks for pronouns and what have you, and there is a culture shift in that regard. But trans people have always been visible. So I always like to preface with that we have existed throughout time, and we have been seen, but we have not had agency to describe our authentic lives and communicate that to the broader public. And so now we have that, and now we have sort of this iceberg of transgender visibility, this transgender tipping point where we have figures and heroines and heroes from the trans community, people of transgender experience, who have done a lot to educate the rest of the world on our experience and our identity and the authenticity of our identity. And with that, you know, there's sort of an assumption now that even though transgender people are in disparity, we're sort of accepted. And if you live anywhere like in Portland or San Francisco, these are areas that are legislatively progressive and affirming of trans people. But I can tell you in San Francisco, the homelessness and the abject poverty that we're seeing for trans people is severe, so much so that in general, San Francisco as a city has been deemed in violation of international human rights law by the United Nations when it comes to addressing the homelessness crisis that we have. And any social issue that we have when it comes to sort of poverty and homelessness and discrimination, all of those elements are amplified for trans people. And so even though we're in this space where we see transgender people on television, I can assure you that the realities of transgender, ordinary, average transgender people who are trying to make sense of their lives, whatever stage they're in, are facing sleeping in tent encampments under the bridge, being marginally housed, sleeping in cars, in overcrowded shelters, and so on and so forth, sleeping on the train, and we're seeing that in droves. I will definitely say the majority of the transgender community, especially the Black transgender community, lives in extreme and abject poverty. And so with the transgender district, though we are going and are a neighborhood for all people under the umbrella of the transgender experience, it's very important to me that we're intentional in addressing the most marginalized groups of our community and the issues that they face. And so something that we are looking into doing is acquiring resources and actual property for housing. And that has been very tricky for me and for everyone else involved with the project, in trying to find ways that we can provide humane, subsidized housing for trans people who are living at the margin, and that is safe and accessible to them, while also sort of making sure that we're not discriminating against from the rest of the public. And so that has been a huge challenge that we've been learning how to navigate, but it is very important to us to make sure that we find creative and innovative ways to immediately house homeless trans people, as well as people who may be at risk of homelessness or houselessness.
Yeah.
And people who have multiple barriers to stability overall. So people who have been formerly incarcerated, people with mental health and or physical disabilities, and so on and so forth.
I appreciate that, and I especially appreciate the challenge of finding and providing housing for folks, especially now.
Yes. Because I think we're all feeling it in the cities that we live in. Mm-hmm. I hear that Portland and the landscape of Portland has changed literally overnight, and it's the same down here in San Francisco. We're seeing it in Los Angeles and LA, Seattle, and even places like New Orleans and Atlanta are having these huge waves of homelessness that these cities have not seen at this level before. And so trying to find housing is literally like trying to find a needle in a haystack. But what we're really trying to do, if anything, is advocate for housing that intentionally serves homeless trans people. And if we can find property or resources to support that mission, then that is icing on the cake.
Are there, are you aware of, how do I want to say, bias studies, I guess, that research or document discrimination against trans people in housing in the Bay Area or in San Francisco proper?
I won't say that I can't think of any studies that have surveyed the incidence of discrimination when it comes to housing. I do know that there are several studies, and National Center of Transgender Equality has done one at the national level, of sort of the experiences of trans people cumulatively experiencing discrimination when it comes to housing. I know that anecdotally, at least from what I've heard and seen, that discrimination is very prominent in San Francisco, partly because the housing that we're looking for is sort of non-traditional housing. So, you know, if you live in a city like Kansas City, you know, your options, or Las Vegas, you have more sort of options to find housing that is solo to the renter, right? So finding like a studio apartment or a one bedroom, or looking at purchasing a home. And so culturally in cities like that, housing is a bit more accessible. When you live in cities like San Francisco, where there's a housing, literally a property shortage because we have an urban growth line, or Portland, Oregon, most sort of people who would fit the socioeconomic bracket of maybe, let's say, a trans woman of color are going to have limited options when it comes to housing, because housing is going to be exponentially more expensive in these areas. And so many people are pursuing roommate housing, living in someone's utility closet in their backyard, which we've seen in the news, and sort of these really other sort of alternative forms of housing. And I think that's where I hear of more discrimination. And it's always the guise of, oh, you just don't blend in with our roommates, or we just don't think it's going to be a fit. And that is what we're seeing. So for trans people who do have some form of employment but maybe low income, are having to find either quote-unquote queer-friendly places to live, and having to, you know, sort of sift through housing opportunities that promote that, and so on. Yeah. And so, and or affordable housing is just also very difficult to come by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Aria, would you tell us, what is the Compton's Transgender Cultural District look like on the ground?
What does it look like on the ground?
Yeah, how will people know where they're at? How will they know when they get there?
So, at the current moment in real time, you don't really have much to go off of. So, if you are a tourist in San Francisco and you wind up in our little area of the city, you probably won't instantly know that you're in the transgender district. However, we have been working tirelessly with the city, and so by Pride, I can assure folks, folks will absolutely know that they are in the transgender district by the middle of June of this year. Mm-hmm. And so for months, we have been working on a placemaking plan that I think will be really iconic and really sort of create an atmosphere celebrating the transgender experience, whether you are trans yourself or an ally or part of the broader queer community. But we will have every streetlight painted in the trans flag color throughout our sort of district within the neighborhood. And all the street signs are being converted to also provide markings that you are in the Compton Transgender District. And that will all sort of happen in mid-June. So you guys are getting the exclusive because I haven't even told anyone in San Francisco that yet. So let's keep it a secret just between us.
Well, thanks so much. What else? What else do you want to tell us about what your long-term vision for the district is?
Yeah. So, for me, as someone who has been leading this process from the beginning, I will say, I think it would be really unique. And something that we're, sorry, let me backtrack. Something that led us to even forming this work, and we didn't know much about a cultural district, nor did we know the impact that it would have on the broader community, to be honest. I don't even think we knew that we'd be, quote unquote, the world's first transgender district. But something that is our core value and something that we daydreamed about was creating an area of the city that would promote the economic advancement of trans people and having businesses owned and operated by transgender people themselves and reimagining a world where we are economically empowered. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the biggest dream is really creating that to where the realities are sobering, that trans people are marginalized. This is something that we know. Of course, I always want to promote that there is more to us than our marginalization and our disenfranchisement, and we can't ignore those realities. And there's also just an exhaustion that I think we have of relying on the rest of the world to fully embrace us as opposed to tolerate us. And so something that's important to us is making sure that we are building work that gives aspiring transgender entrepreneurs opportunities to stabilize themselves when it comes to housing and employment, and making sure that we're providing as many of those opportunities to all members of the community, with centering our most marginalized. And so that's work that we're building for the long term, is finding ways uniquely to create co-op grocery stores, cannabis clubs, bars, nightlife, et cetera, that is owned, operated, facilitated by, and you name it, led by trans people themselves. Is very important to us, as in a reverse capitalism model as well.
Yeah, got to work with and against.
Mm-hmm.
To make good things happen. Well, we have time for, I think, last thoughts, Aria. Do you have any? We miss you here. They'll tell you that.
Oh my gosh, thank you. I feel like I'm back home. Oh gosh. But yeah, just that I think there's so much work happening across the country, of brilliant, talented advocates, doing amazing work, towards advancing the trans community in so many ways, both in Portland, here in San Francisco, and I just met with a group of Black trans women from the Deep South who are doing incredible work with absolutely no resources and a whole different arena of stigma and violence against trans people that I just don't live because I'm from the West Coast. Of course, to anyone listening, just to support those efforts both locally and ensuring that, you know, you're supporting not just monetarily, but also volunteering with projects that are grassroots and led by trans people who are most impacted by structural and institutional and social sort of disenfranchisement means the world to our work.
Wonderful. Ariak, best of luck. I hope the new unveilings in June go perfectly. And I will check in with you down the road to see how things are going with the project. We've been chatting with Aria Saeed. Yeah, thank you. Executive Director of the Compton's Transgender Cultural District in San Francisco. Aria, it's been a pleasure.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. We're going to hear a little Spacer, and we'll come back soon. right, that was the full version of Spacer. Sheila in B Devotion, Sheila B Devotion, and other variations. We're coming up, I think, on the 40th anniversary of the release of that single. So we'll throw a party when that happens. Thank you to Somia and Kieran working in the booth tonight, keeping us electric and on the air. We're trying to pull up an interview, get somebody on the line to chat with who we're struggling to get on the air. But so I'm going to talk a little bit about what we were going to talk about ourselves, which was police presence at Pride. I'm going to read a quote. This is from Miss Major. I'll read the parts of it I can read on the air. She says, "The police have been monsters. They're all worthless, unimaginable, horrible people, and destructive to mankind in general, especially to my trans and gender nonconforming community. I don't know who invited those mothers to be in the Pride Parade. They are the most detrimental thing to ever happen. These people are only out to arrest, put us in jail, lock us up, beat us up, get us to perform oral sex, then kick us out of the car naked to go home. I know exactly what I'm talking about. They should never have been in the Pride Parade." So that's Miss Major. We have Dr. Nick Muley on the line. Is that correct, Nick? Can't hear Nick just yet. So I'll read the rest of Miss Major's quote. Okay. The rest of Miss Major's quote runs, "Blank a flag. That doesn't mean a damn thing if you're not going to treat people right or fair or honesty." Nick, are you in the line with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
I can. Wonderful. I'm glad to hear your voice for the first time. There's so much we're going to try and get in here. But first, do you want to introduce yourself for our listeners? It'd be a great place to start.
Sure. I mean, given what we're talking about, I am the founder of Queer Ontario. We're a sex-positive queer liberationist group with a provincial mandate for the province of Ontario, looking at trying to make sure that the issues, needs, concerns of the LGBTQ populations here are being addressed. And given the subject matter of what we're talking about, something we did last fall was call a public meeting in response to a concern that Pride Toronto had decided on its own volition to invite the police back into Pride Parade. And at the public forum that we called in November, we formed a coalition called the No Pride in Police Coalition that has since protested that decision. So that's just kind of in a nutshell. Apart from that, I'm a professor of social work at York University in Toronto.
I watched a video online of you discussing the question of how to describe Israeli apartheid in some situations. Do you remember this video?
Yes, I do. Because we had quite a controversy here. It could be 9 years ago now, where Pride Toronto, in its decision back then to try to ban Qaya, queers against Israeli apartheid, mm-hmm. from being in the parade, mm-hmm. due to political pressure they were under. And there was a backlash from those of us at the community level, not to engage in that kind of, exclusionary tactic. So yes, I remember doing that interview back then because that was quite a controversy then.
We discussed pinkwashing and related subjects quite a bit here on Preference. So I was glad to see the work you're doing on that as well. I want to read something that came across my phone just a few minutes ago. It's an article on one of those awful news websites, but whatever. the Reclaim Pride Coalition in New York is creating a queer liberation march to debut this year, next month in June. And it will, according to this article, differ from your typical Pride parade in two big ways: no cops, no corporate floats. So let's start. Let's go from there.
Right. And good on them.
Mm-hmm.
it's interesting. You kind of tapped into something that we're struggling with at No Pride in Police Coalition here in Toronto, and that is that, you know, many of us who are members of that coalition have quite a critique about police presence as well as corporations. And yet, early in our process, we had to develop a basis of unity for the coalition, and that basis of unity was very much around this concern around police presence at Pride. And so we're struggling with this in the sense that it's one of those internal things that I'm just being, you know, very upfront and explicit with you about, and these are struggles that happen, tensions that happen within political groups, and that is that, you know, as much as many of us are really concerned about police presence, we're going to continue to advocate against that. There's also equal concern about the presence of corporations at Pride and how corporatized Pride has become. And I think some of us are feeling a little uneasy about almost sidelining that issue because we're putting so much attention on the police.
Mm-hmm.
And I know at Queer Ontario, like our own group, we haven't lost sight of that critique, and we're trying to figure out a way to make sure that that doesn't disappear in this process. So I'm happy to hear that New York is getting organized around that, and especially it's a big year for them with the 50th anniversary of Stonewall and the fact that they're hosting World Pride. Good on them, for real, you know, taking on, again, that queer liberationist kind of perspective and, you know, reclaiming that so that we don't lose sight of those important values.
Now, we're talking about Pride Toronto, that No Pride in Policing Coalition has been working to disinvite, I suppose, police participation. Does that include the preparations, the infrastructure of holding a march or a festival, or is it limited to police participation in the march and festival, if that's how it works, itself?
Yeah, it is very much the latter, where we were asking for no institutional presence within the festivities itself. So on the one hand, we're not saying that they can't be at the festival doing their job, which is keeping the peace and ensuring safety and that sort of thing. If they're there on the job, on duty, doing that, that's fine. The real issue is when they are participating in the parade in uniform, using their vehicles as you know, decoys or floats, and basically parading themselves through the parade. And here in Toronto, it's not just the Toronto Police Service that does this. It's all the surrounding police services as well. And it turns into this really large paramilitary contingent of police services, one after the other, that goes through the parade. And it will go on for a very long time. I never timed it, but it really feels like you're at a paramilitary parade, at least for that segment of the parade.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's really disturbing about this, and really, you know, what needs to be noted here, is that all of this really stemmed from demands that were put forth by Black Lives Matter a few years earlier, when they were the honored group. And they had been complaining about this for some time. I mean, in the very formation and foundation of Black Lives Matter, both there in the U.S. and here in Canada, is the concern of police shooting and, in many instances, killing black men. And that has happened here in Toronto. And Black Lives Matter here in Toronto has quite a queer presence within it. Mm. In the year that they were the honored group, you may have heard of this, I think it was in 2016, when they were marching through the parade as honored group, they stopped at a major intersection and refused to keep marching until a set of demands were signed by the executive director of Pride Toronto, which he was rushed over to after they stalled the parade for a good half hour And he did sign off on it. He ended up losing his job in the process for doing that. But it was one of their demands. They had a whole slew of demands, but one of their demands was that there was to be no institutional police presence at Pride. And I'm sharing all of that because it's a segment of our community who are quite disturbed by the very presence of the police, because they are seen as a threat to their existence as Black people. And we've seen that in very harsh ways in terms of the carding of Black people, in terms of the higher numbers of arrests, the imprisonment of Black people. The rates are much higher than other populations, both Indigenous and Black people, and the shootings, particularly of Black men. And so as a community, we felt you can't leave anyone behind, or at least some of us felt that way. You know, we do have our varying opinions within the community, but, you know, this coalition, you know, the No Pride in Police coalition, fully endorses all the demands that Black Lives Matter have put forward, and that's how we got around supporting them on this. And the disturbing thing was that last fall, the executive director of Pride Toronto, Olivia Numa, on her own volition, made the decision to reinvite the police back, and that's where we reacted as a community, because it was subverting a decision that was made by Pride Toronto's own membership to support Black Lives Matter and all their demands. This was voted on twice by the membership, and it was supported twice, and yet she went and did this on her own.
When you say membership in and being able to vote on police presence, what does that mean? What does it look like?
Yeah. Okay. So I should separate that out. So Pride Toronto has a membership system. So you can take out a membership with Pride Toronto, and that would give you the right to vote at their annual general meeting. You could run for a board position. You have a bit of a voice there, and so that's what that means. What complicates this a bit is that in the No Pride in Policing coalition, some of our members are actual members of Pride Toronto and are trying to influence Pride Toronto from the inside. Others of us in the coalition are not members of Pride Toronto because we are so put off by Pride Toronto, we don't want to give them a penny of our money to even be a member, right? So, but within our own coalition, we live with each other, right? We say, you know, there is value in being a member, there's value in also staying outside of that. And we respect that amongst each other. But to answer your question, within Pride Toronto itself, it does have a membership structure, and people can take out a membership. I think it's like $10. And then you can attend meetings and you can vote on motions. You can, table a motion, things like that. You have a bit of a voice, and then decisions can be made. So there were two occasions in which Pride Toronto was confronted with these demands by Black Lives Matter, and the membership voted in favor of those demands on both those occasions.
And the current ban on police participation in Pride is open-ended, is that correct?
Sorry, what do you mean by open-ended?
That it would have to be specifically revoked in order for police to be invited to participate in the parade itself.
It's a good question. I mean, the executive director attempted to bring them back just by her stating that. That whole thing blew up though because of our backlash. If we had risen and confronted her and Pride Toronto on that, and no one said anything, I think the police would have been quite prepared to say, "All right, we're back in."
Mm-hmm. What else can you tell us about policing issues in Toronto?
The tensions are pretty high right now, not only with regard to the threat of towards Black men by the police, but we've had a very serious situation over the past year and a half with a serial killer in the gay neighborhood. That members of our community have been going to the police and saying to them that they believed there was a serial killer, that men were going missing, out there causing serious damage because we just can't find these men and stuff. And the police tried to stave that off, or they didn't take that seriously. They have now caught the person and have since admitted that indeed he is the serial killer and the one responsible for all these men missing. Their body parts were found in numerous planters and potteries and things because the serial killer himself was a landscaper. And this has not been resolved. This has really shaken up the community. There's a lot of distrust between us and the police. There always has been. There's always been a troublesome relationship right back from the bathhouse raids in the early 80s, even before. And so, I mean, the timing of Pride Toronto attempting to bring them back in became really curious to the community when here we are in an unresolved situation with a serial killer scenario, and to be invited back just didn't make any sense. It started to make sense to us when we realized that the federal government was offering Pride Toronto a fairly large amount of money, over $700,000, close to $800,000, I believe, just under $1 million, to do nationwide consultations on safety for LGBTQ people. And this wasn't apparent to us at first when the invitation for the police to come back came about, but we were quick to connect those dots once that happened to realize that in order to accept these funds from the federal government, Pride Toronto needed to have good relations with the police. And the ED of Pride Toronto obviously saw that re-inviting them back into the parade was a route to do that. And then she can get her hands on that money and then be the organization to host the consultations. And this is an organization, Pride Toronto, that has no history of doing this kind of work. They've not conducted research in the past of this nature. They have a long history of financial mismanagement and a real troubled political history, both on their boards and with numerous past EDs. Why the government would go to them is a huge mystery to me, but why they decided to invite the police back when they did was because they were on the cusp of getting this money. And what becomes really apparent is that at least the current ED of Pride and the board that they recently had, because many of them have since left with all this controversy, are more answerable to politicians, the police, and corporations than they are to the community itself. And that's where a lot of us are reacting, because Pride Toronto is an organization that puts on a festivity, a major Pride event every year, that means less and less and less to us as LGBTQ people than it does to Tourism Toronto. And I think that's really unfortunate.
Nick, we're running low on time, which is unfortunate. It's our fault we couldn't have gotten a hold of you sooner. We're learning how to make international calls.
Right.
I would not have guessed that calling Canada required extra and more extra, but it does. And I couldn't do it on my phone. It said I had to go get a special card at my phone shop. Do you have last thoughts for us, Nick?
I know you didn't share a whole lot about what's happening there in your area. I do know this is a controversy not only here in Toronto or here in Canada. I know it's propping up many places across the U.S., as you mentioned, New York. I do international research. I was just recently in London, and there's a huge controversy there as well, and in many major cities. So my last thoughts are just that, you know, we seem to be losing a grip on what Pride's real reasoning was all about. And it's not to say that we can't party. People try to place a dividing line between politics and partying. But I think this aspect of the politics is getting lost in this process, where a kind of capitalist, corporatized police presence, you know, political, meaning politicians type influence on our event has just swung in their direction so much that we are really losing our voice in the process. And I think we really have to take a hold of that and yank bringing it back down to the community level so that it's meaningful for us and not about how much more dollars you can bring in for Pride, you know, the Pride organization itself, or for the economy for that matter.
Indeed, indeed. We don't have a strong pushback on Pride yet. I think folks are still kind of atomized and working on some other issues. I've also been following Black and Pink in Chicago, so, you know, and I think Minneapolis had some interesting work done last year just on this issue. Nick, thank you so much for joining us to talk about No Pride in Policing.
Thanks for having me. And sorry that we couldn't connect sooner, but we ultimately did, and that's what's important.
Yeah. Thank you so much. This has been Preference. Calculated Conversation is coming up next. Thanks, listeners.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up, Calculated Conversation.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Lessons for a New Generation of Organizers. A talk with David Rainey on Thursday, May 16th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Ask Me Union Hall in Portland. David Rainey, Professor Emeritus in the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He is also the author of the new book, Living and Dying on the Factory Floor, From Outside In and the Inside Out. The event is also sponsored by the Institute of Anarchist Studies and the Burgerville Workers Union. Again, that's Lessons for a New Generation of Organizers, a talk with David Rainey on Thursday, May 16th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Ask Me Union Hall